thank you very much. We're now going to start the next panel, which is midstream outside of Texas, so the rest of the country. Believe it or not, there is a part of the country outside of Texas, although we sometimes forget about that. I'd like to introduce the panelists this morning. Starting on the right, Kate Walsh, the Vice President of Investor Relations with EnLink Midstream, and to her left, Pete Boylan, the CEO of Cypress Energy Partners, and then Tim Knox, President of Compresco Inc., or Compresco LP, sorry, it is an MLP. So I guess the question, you know, what basins will we deal with in this? There's a lot of territory to cover, and each of the panelists has some expertise in some of them, not all of them. I think when we think about the areas outside of the Texas area from a midstream perspective, the obvious main areas are, I'm going to kind of highlight those, and then we're going to ask the panelists to kind of give their views on each of those areas. You know, we're talking about, of course, the Rockies and the Bakken up in that area, and there's a lot of activity to talk about there. Of course, in Oklahoma, we've got the Scoop, Stack, and further west, the Granite Wash area. So we'll look to talk a little bit about that. We'll also touch a little bit on the Ark-La-Tex. I know it touches on Texas, but it also extends into Louisiana and the Arkansas area, an area of significant activity. And last but not least, the Marcellus and Utica. And that's an area that the panelists aren't active in, but we'll touch on it nonetheless and talk a little bit about that. So with that, let's start with everyone's view. I'm going to ask the panel their views on, you know, what's been happening outside of the Permian and the Texas basins over the last year. I mean, we've seen a pickup in activity. Obviously, there's tremendous activity in the Texas and the Permian area, but outside of that area, different basins have been picking up at different speeds as the economics of drilling have improved and so forth. So we're kind of curious about how things are going. And so I'll start with Kate over and let her talk about, because EnLink's fairly active in the mid-continent area. Maybe give us your views on what's happening in that area, drilling activity, need for infrastructure, how it's impacting the midstream, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to answer that question. So EnLink does have a big position in the Stack. And what we've seen over the past 12 months or so is fundamentally rigs coming back. So this time last year, we had about 6 active rigs on our dedicated acreage, and today we're at 18. So really tremendous growth from a rig perspective. And although an imperfect measure of activity, we think that it does indicate what we are expecting to see in terms of a volume ramp. So we're expecting to grow by 60% in volumes when we contrast 2016 to 2017, which is tremendous growth in that area for us. The Stack was one of the more resilient plays during the downturn, so I think that it was the play that saw the least amount of rigs coming off, but we certainly see rig activity picking up significantly, and we expect to see at least 25 rigs on our acreage by the end of 2017. So continuing to see that trend continue, which is exciting for us and on our footprint. What that means for us is when rigs come back that we have to build out the gathering and the processing. So from an EnLink standpoint, we're going to be dedicating about $400 million of capital to the Stack play specifically out of a budget of around $600 million. So the large proportion of our budget for capital expenditures this year will be going to the Stack play to help support the producer growth in that area. In addition to rigs increasing, we're also seeing a lot of new technology impacting the basin. So some of our producers are drilling 10,000-foot laterals, which is impressive, to say the least. Mm-hmm. So that's exciting for us as well. And they're also transitioning from single-well drilling to multi-pad drilling. And so we're seeing up to 20 wells drilled per section, which is also new and also supports, I think, a very solid volume trajectory of growth throughout this year and into 2018. So all in all, I think with prices coming back, we see the rigs coming back, and for midstreams, it's very positive in terms of volume growth.
Just to add some further questions, of course, you've got the affiliation with Devon. And talk a little bit about, you know, the mix of business in terms of new business with Devon versus sort of third parties in that area.
Yeah. Great question. Devon is our sponsor, and they're very supportive of EnVenLink and our footprint in the stack. But they were hit hard by the crude prices falling, and they were down to 2 rigs this time last year. So 2 out of the 6 rigs that we had. So we had good diversity of producer customers. They have 6 rigs now out of the 18 rigs we have. So we still have good diversity. And what we've seen in the stack particularly is what we're referring to as high grading of customers. And so some of the smaller producers there have been bought out by larger producers. So Marathon bought the Payrock acreage, and that has been great for us. Marathon's a great producer customer and is looking to do a lot with their acreage in the stack. And then Newfield bought some of the Chesapeake acreage and is doing tremendous things there. We have 4 Newfield rigs running on our acreage today. So we are experiencing, I think, bigger players coming into the stack. And we refer to it internally as the land of the giants to contrast it to the Permian, where I think there's a lot of smaller or mid-sized players. The stack is really becoming a place where you see larger producers taking the big portions of the play. It is a smaller play than the Permian, so there's that difference as well. But Newfield has indicated that they're going to go to full field development in 2017, so they're picking up activity. And so I think all in all, yeah, very positive.
Very positive. All right. Mm-hmm. And in terms of not to dwell on it, but we'll sort of focus on each one, and then we'll turn around. Everyone will get their turn. But if Pete or Tim have any comments to add as we talk about different basins, please jump in. But takeaway capacity, you know, for NGLs and natural gas, where's most of the product going, and how do you see the picture on takeaway capacity?
Yeah, great question. Takeaway capacity in the stack scoop area is a hot topic these days. We don't feel there's any near-term pressure. So essentially, Oklahoma has about 9 BCF of takeaway capacity out of the state, and there's only 4 BCF being produced today. So there's really no pressure. What is important to know is that the takeaway capacity may not be going to premier markets, so those with a nice, healthy basis differential. So we see potential projects being proposed that would take away that gas to the premier markets, like the Waha hub and the ship channel. And so we think that that'll be something that the industry will be focused on right now. The problem we're having, and we've got a solution to that takeaway capacity with an Oklahoma Express pipeline project that we've been talking about a bit, but it has not been green-lighted because we're having trouble with producers signing up for the takeaway capacity. So we internally call it Chesapeake-itis, in that producers are not willing to sign up for a long-term takeaway just coming out of the downturn, and I think they're a little hesitant to sign up for more takeaway capacity. So, I think Cheniere has proposed a project that goes through Bennington, and so our internal thought is that a project will get green-lighted that goes through Bennington, but it will be not in the short term. I think it'll take a little while to get that green-lighted.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. Pete, just to turn to you, maybe we'll talk about the Rockies, some of your area of activity.
Sure. Good morning, everybody. The DJ in the Rockies is one of the better plays in the country right now, and there's currently 21 rigs active, up about 62% from the trough, still down about 67% from the peak in September of 14. But what's most impressive is the tremendous improvement in efficiency gains that you're seeing there. The EIA tracks a lot of different metrics, but the one that really jumps out is the gain in single well productivity. And it stands out higher than any other basin, 11.9 times increase from 2011 to 2017. From back in 11, 108 barrels a day, to today, almost 1,300 barrels a day, 1,283 barrels a day. So the region's producing a lot of oil, a significant amount of gas. The gas wells are very attractive. You've got a number of large operators, similar to some of the dynamics that Kate was mentioning, and in particular, Noble and Anadarko are having very successful activities there. They also have midstream, entities that are able to take advantage of the midstream opportunities associated with the gas, the water, the oil, et cetera. So it's a great place to be, and a substantial amount of activity coming out of the downturn.
And in terms of the Bakken, any comments on what's happening up in the Bakken area?
The Bakken is really changed dramatically over that same period of time. I think in the peak, sometime around 11, there were 218 rigs working. Today, there's about 35 rigs, up about 59% from the trough, which was May of 16, where I think we got down to about 23 rigs. And it was amazing if you went up there and 11 and 12, you couldn't get a hotel room, the roads were packed, stuff was being built everywhere, and if you came back in May of 16, it was like a ghost town. Tremendous amount of job loss, bankruptcies, et cetera. The economics in the Bakken are not as advantaged as the economics are in many other places, the Permian certainly, and the DJ. And so you've got a tale of two worlds, obviously. E&P companies that have the multi-basin exposure and the ability to pivot and deploy capital in other basins are deploying capital disproportionately to those other basins that have better economics. Having said all of that, the Bakken has seen a 4.2 times increase in the single well productivity going from 2011 to 2017, and the efficiency gains as well have been very substantial, and you're seeing oil wells that produce, up to 986 barrels a day versus about 234 back in 2011. So some of the same dynamics you've heard about elsewhere, efficiency in the drilling, pad drilling, longer laterals, tremendous amount of proppant, huge volumes of water. The same themes are following through, and the acreage has been high-graded, and if a producer has got the acreage held and doesn't have to drill and they've got an opportunity to redeploy that capital in another basin, they are. So we've got a saltwater disposal well business with about 9 facilities up there. And we have seen the impact of, the downturn. And it's exciting now to finally see rig count growing again and activity picking up. So I'm optimistic that the worst is behind us and we'll start to see some more activity up there.
All right, great. Tim, give us your perspective. I mean, from the both from the compression side, but to the extent you want to comment on some of the basins that we haven't talked about so far,
Yeah, I think it's important to kind of calibrate for the audience that the business that we're in is specifically compression services. We are not we are not marketing pipeline capacity or gas contracts. We are a compression service and compression equipment provider. So what has been talked about would be kind of that eastern part of the mid-continent, the Fayetteville and Haynesville. So in Fayetteville, not a lot going on, hasn't been for a while. We do provide wellhead compression services there, so gas $3 is certainly better in that business than gas at $2, where we can put equipment out as production enhancement on old wells. Go south to the Haynesville, it's a bit surprising. Rig count has doubled in the past year, And that's not huge numbers, somewhere around 30 rigs where it was 15 a year ago. But in terms of percent increase, it's one of the higher of all the producing regions. So that's pretty encouraging. We've seen the opportunities increase there. And then you look at the LNG terminals under construction. In addition to Cheniere, there's five or six that are under construction and three or four more that have FERC approval. I think we all know that LNG is probably oversupplied out a few years. So that's going to come down to where is the cheapest gas and who's got the best port location to get to the markets. From the cost of gas, you certainly got to think that the Haynesville proximity to the Gulf Coast should be attractive. Now, the speaker this morning mentioned that the production economics in the Haynesville are not as attractive as Marcellus and Utica and some other places. Hopefully, as more drilling's done, innovation that's been applied elsewhere will start to be applied to the Haynesville, and some of the efficiency improvements will also come along in that play. So we're optimistic about that. We have seen some smaller midstream gathering and processing companies struggle the past couple of years in that area, and that's starting to settle out now, but there's some opportunities there, and it might be to go pick up some compression equipment. It might be some consolidation. But some places there that we are optimistic, again, that business will continue to pick up in the coming, call it 12, 24 months.
So as you look at the environment, I've seen some interesting data from, for example, DCP puts out a slide about the growth in Gulf Coast gas demand and NGL demand and so forth as the both exports but also the petrochem build out on the Gulf Coast. And so as you extend out in concentric circles from the Gulf Coast, of course, we pick up some of the Texas basins, but then as you get into other areas, including the Marcellus, how do you kind of view the different basins as being positioned over the next few years to compete, and then how does that create a midstream opportunity? But it's a far-reaching question, but maybe I'll pose it to Kate. We can work down the line. How do you view what you're doing in the Mid-Continent, how it competes with the Marcellus Utica, for example?
Yeah, interesting question. I think what we're expecting to see is the Marcellus and Utica gas to push to the Midwest and certainly the Chicago market, which will stop gas flow from the Permian and central Oklahoma to go up north. But we feel that there'll be really strong demand pull from the Mexican markets as well as the LNG markets off the Gulf Coast. So we expect to see a lot of gas flow down to the LNG corridor as well as Mexico, which should not cause any gas glut or basis crisis that we're foreseeing.
All right, good. So you think there's enough room to Let Marcellus Utica go Midwest and the central basins, if you will, service the Gulf Coast market primarily.
Yep, that's exactly it.
And Pete, on the oil side, just to talk Rockies and Bakken, takeaway capacity, the Dakota Access Pipeline, for example, how do you see that impacting the Bakken in the near and long term?
Well, clearly the producer economics are going to improve the well-publicized pipeline proceeds, and you have less of the oil being railed with the associated economics and more being piped, and it'll enhance those overall returns and economics. The DJ has got pretty good connectivity and so they've got good optionality, smaller differentials, and I think that will continue to be the case.
Okay, great. Tim, dynamics in your business. I mean, as we get a large number of older vintage wells, how does that impact the need for compression and so forth?
Right, and it's certainly in older wells as they deplete, as infill drilling has not been done a lot the past few years, as some of the workovers haven't been done, certainly can benefit the compression business. Again, all the way from the wellhead to larger volumes of gas going into gathering and processing systems. Interesting panel for me to be on. We're actually founded in Midland, Texas, of all places, and we're on a non-Texas discussion. And we have about 50% of our assets deployed in the Permian Basin and then throw in South Texas to that as well. So those areas where we are most concentrated, there's always old wells. There's a lot of new production coming in as well that that we're able to serve. We look up into the Marcellus on the discussion of takeaway. We are underrepresented by all accounts in the Marcellus, 20% of the U.S. gas, and we have perhaps less than 5% of our fleet deployed there. But we'll look at that, and we see the opportunity as opposed to go fighting for market share with the existing conditions. As the takeaway improves between now and 2020, I think it's 15 BCF a day of additional takeaway, great opportunity for compression services for us to expand with that as that market grows again.
Well, we can talk a little bit about Texas if you feel the need. That's all right. I'm going to sort of ask about where, you know, as you look at these non-Texas basins, and you can talk a little bit about Texas if you want, but concentrating out of the different areas, where do you see the big midstream opportunities these days? Going back to the areas that we've talked about, and we haven't talked about the Granite Wash, for example, yet. So I'm interested in if anyone has any thoughts on, is that basin, you know, going to see a pickup in activity, and what kind of activity? But let's start, Kate. You know, in terms of the basins, obviously you guys are focused mid-continent, but how do you see the landscape and where do you see the best opportunities outside of the Permian, for example, these days?
Yeah, as far as EnLink is concerned, we're in the basins that we want to be in. We're not looking to get into the Bakken or get a bigger exposure to the Marcellus and Utica. So I don't see us as a midstream player expanding basin-wise. I think where we see the opportunities is perhaps MLP consolidation.
Mm-hmm.
I think that our internal view is that there are too many MLPs out there right now, and we would welcome some types of mergers going on.
That's an interesting question. So consolidation with the view to having a larger position, be more concentrated, or to achieve diversification?
From our standpoint, it would be the former. And so, yeah, we think that size and scale is paramount in some of these big basins, and so to achieve that, I think you may have to merge or acquire another MLP or midstream player.
Okay. Pete?
Well, we have been looking for midstream acquisition opportunities to further diversify our small MLP, and we've spent a lot of time in multiple basins, and the pricing is very expensive in the Permian in particular right now, and there's been some transactions year to date that I think have surprised people with both the level of interest demand and pricing those assets command. But the growth profile might be there to support some of those values. We have looked at a variety of different midstream assets, including water, gas, oil, and even some other products, refined fuels, et cetera. And so it really is a very micro-level discussion and analysis. The Northeast has some major debottlenecking projects underway, and big guys are building very big systems that you've read about, some of the actions with the new administration freeing up some of the permitting and entitlements. And so for somebody like us, we need to look at smaller opportunities. There's been a dramatic increase in the number of private equity-backed sponsors that have acquired attractive acreage, attractive production, that are interested in building out that acreage and willing to joint venture and or outsource the associated midstream infrastructure that's needed. And, you know, most people today want to quad pipe an opportunity to gain efficiencies. And when I say quad pipe, they want to have a right-of-way, and they want to have an oil line, a gas line, a produced water line to keep the trucks off the road, and then oftentimes a freshwater line because, again, the intensity of water being used in these completions, in the Permian, for example, there are many producers now that are using 600,000 barrels of water on a single completion. To put that in context, that would be 5,000 truckloads of water for a single well. Well, if you go talk about pad drilling where you might have five wells being drilled on a single pad, it doesn't work to be trucked. And so you're seeing massive storage facilities being built, interconnected with water. And so we think there's some opportunities there because all producers are interested in an attractive LOE cost structure, with their model and pursuing the highest return opportunities, which are often associated with the drill bit.
So on that, just an interesting question, and it probably varies basin to basin, but in terms of the water situation, how much of that water will come back? I was surprised, for example, on a project I worked on in the Marcellus where I think it was about 20% of the frack water actually came back. So back in the olden days, we used to get worried about water staying in the formation.
Right.
But that apparently isn't a problem these days. How much is coming back, and what's changing in terms of the environmental issues on disposal,
So the what's coming back is really a basin by basin and even within a basin, a geology-specific question. And it can range anywhere from 20% to as much as 60%, depending upon the formation that the particular producer is pursuing for the target. So it really varies dramatically. And then as it relates to water stewardship, you've got a lot of things going on. So up in the Northeast, for example, you can't get a saltwater disposal well permit in Pennsylvania, generally speaking. You can get them in West Virginia and in Ohio, but the SWDs there don't take a lot of water relative to what an SWD might do in the SCOOP or the STACK or the DJ or the Permian or the Eagle Ford, et cetera. And so many producers have had to develop recycling programs. And recycling means many different things to different people. And the first question is, what are you trying to clean up the water to do? Are you trying to bring it all the way back to potable water? Are you trying to clean it up enough to be able to discharge legally in a stream or a pond? Or are you trying to clean it up enough to use for the next completion in a way that will work with the completion chemical program and technology that the particular producer's proposing? So you see a lot of different things up in the Marcellus in particular because of those issues, and ultimately it leads to a substantially higher LOE cost just associated with handling the water in, say, contrast to what a producer would need to spend in the SCOOP or the STACK or the Permian or the Eagle Ford. It's all over the map.
Okay. Tim, your opportunities that you see in your area, basins, and we don't have to restrict ourselves outside of Texas.
That's okay. Pete mentioned earlier the DJ and the Peon, so that is a spot that we are very encouraged. We've seen pickups recently. We even decided to do some consolidation of facilities and increased our physical footprint in Greeley over the past 6 months or so. So we're very encouraged. I hope that spreads west a little bit over towards Uinta, but we're very encouraged with the DJ. You asked earlier about consolidation that might occur. So in this compression services business, there's one great big player as far as market share, about 30%, and there's three of us that are in the 10 to 15% range, maybe 8 to 12%. And after that, it's very small and very fragmented. The big guys are all MLPs. The others aren't. So there's only three or four MLPs in this compression services business. Of the fragmented companies, 50,000 horsepower, 100,000 horsepower, so value-wise, $50 million, $100 million. Most of those are PE-backed, and with the pressure that's been on service rates the past couple of years, we're probably getting to a point where some PE groups don't see the IRRs for growth, for new equipment builds. And we anticipate, at least I anticipate, that there might be some opportunity in the coming 12 months where some of those fragmented, smaller PE-backed compression service providers might look to monetize. And so that could be a good opportunity for us. And most of those groups tend to be very regional. Might be Permian, might be Marcellus, might be East Texas. So we're looking forward to that and hope to participate in it.
Next question, and it relates to the one you touched on, this cost of capital, size, and simplification. So I'll ask each of the panelists, sort of the views on, in your particular case or in general, what do you think can be done to help lower your cost of capital, and what do you think needs to happen in the MLP industry with respect to simplification or consolidation and so forth? So I'll put that to Katie. You don't have to say anything non-public at this stage, but...
No, absolutely. From an EnLink standpoint, it is our number one question these days is if we're going to simplify our structure and either roll up our MLP into our GP or tuck in our GP underneath our MLP. We have consistently said it's not a priority for us right now. We find that those that tend to do a corporate simplification from a cost of capital standpoint have cash flow from their MLP to their IDRs that the GP holds in the range of 30%. So there is a huge cash flow going to the GP from an IDR standpoint. We don't have that today. Only about 10% of our MLP cash flows are going to our GP in the form of IDRs. So we don't have that pressure. We also find that some of our peers are pressured to do a simplification because of cash tax burdens at the GP. We don't have that pressure either. We came out in January with multi-year guidance for cash taxes at the GP level saying that we don't expect to pay more than $5 million a year for 17, 18, and 19. So no immediate cash tax burden that we're facing. And then what we've seen also is perhaps a larger strategic initiative at play when these simplifications are done, like a backdoor distribution cut. And that's not in our plans either. So we don't see the need for a simplification because of those three drivers aren't pressuring us today. And in fact, we really like having the dual currency of publicly traded GP as a C Corp and then the MLP as well. It's been really advantageous for us in the M&A market. When Crosstex merged with Devon, the GP was pivotal in doing that structuring. And then also most recently in January of 2016, we bought midstream assets from Tall Oak Midstream, and we issued $250 million of equity out of our GP to help get that deal done. So we like it. We think it actually can be an advantage in M&A these days. So we're not going to simplify, but I know there's a lot of speculation out there that we might.
So Pete, I'll ask a slightly different question. So you sit there and, you know, smaller MLP, higher cost of capital. What's your sort of thought process in terms of how do I improve my cost of capital and so forth? Is it you know, merge, get bigger? Is it just wait for prices to get better? You know, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. So I think there's 110 or something MLPs out there. Virtually everybody faced pretty significant headwinds and pressure during this two-year downturn that started in November of 14 with OPEC's actions, and finally the thaw has begun to lift, with the election, with a president that's very pro-energy, and then OPEC in the accord that was agreed to in November of 16. So in our case, we saw our small business contract substantially in the downturn as it continued for 2 years. And I think every one of those MLPs, saw the same pressure. And depending upon where somebody was in the cycle, the ones that were, most impacted were people that were likely too aggressive with M&A, and they overpaid for assets and 2013, 2014, nobody was anticipating a downturn, let alone a downturn that would be of the scope and significance that would go on for 2 years. And so you also had some new asset classes, upstream MLPs, which by definition are a pretty tough business to place in an MLP because of the capital intensity and what's required to effectively replace your reserves and grow that cash flow. And so when you go look at all of the MLPs, there's been a ton of simplification transactions. I think there's over 40 some odd MLPs that were forced to cut their dividends. Some cut them multiple times. Some, all the upstream, I think, suspended their dividends. And so it really is a case-by-case situation. And as Kate mentioned, you know, a lot depended upon the IDR drag that existed at a given point in time. And there was a period of time where it was very fashionable to have a huge backlog of projects that needed to be financed. And when you had unlimited access to both debt and equity, that was viewed positively, and that organic, you know, growth CapEx program was something nobody really worried about. Mm-hmm. In fact, it was viewed positively. Well, during the downturn, that became a problem. And so you saw many very good companies just have to deal with the realities of lower volumes and activities coming from their E&P clients, for the most part, that rippled through their business. And so they had to address debt levels. They had to address covenant issues and so forth. So I think there probably still are too many MLPs out there. And you will see additional consolidation, I believe. The cost of capital question's always an important one. In our case, we're a very small MLP, we saw a significant decline in our cash flow during the downturn. And as Kate mentioned, we see a lot of advantages to having a GP. We don't have any current IDR drag on our LP, and we look at large acquisition opportunities that we couldn't do today in the LP up at the GP, where we have the resources to do those transactions and then drop them down into the LP on accretive terms. And so for those reasons, we supported our distribution as a general partner, and we own about 65% of the LP, so our interests are fully aligned with our minority unit holders. And that isn't always the case. You see a lot of MLPs where the GP doesn't have any real substantive economic ownership in the LP, and that can cause them to sometimes make business decisions that are mm-hmm. different than somebody like ourselves might yeah. make.
Very good. Tim, your view on cost of capital and how that impacts your ability to grow, or how your strategy to chase opportunities?
So with our industry, again, providing compression services, we certainly have more idle assets now than we had 2.5 years ago. It was not hit like drilling contractors or like pressure pumping was, but 10%, 15% decline in utilized assets. So our first growth at this point is to redeploy the assets we have, and there's a little bit of rework that's required sometimes, but that's a fraction of the cost of putting new equipment into a compression services fleet. The next place to grow revenues is to start to recoup some of the price discounting that's been done for the past 2 years. Our industry is a little bit of a lag, certainly behind frac companies, so maybe that's still 4 quarters away before the utilization of those idle assets goes up, and then that somewhat naturally drives the service rates up. So the first couple places there. And now there is more, the markets are a bit more open for equity and debt. Now when you're paying a distribution and you're trying to keep that distribution high, swapping out debt for equity is not always a lower cost of capital. It depends where the yield is. So we'll watch that and monitor that as we go forward. But again, the first steps in growth in our industry are to redeploy, put idle assets back to work, and then to get the pricing back up.
Well, I think we're out of time, and my apologies, I didn't allow time for questions, but it is a coffee break next, so if anyone has a question or two, maybe we can encroach on the coffee break time. Yeah, so the question is, outside of Texas, are we exploring opportunities in Canada or in Mexico? I'll pose that to whoever would like to talk about that.
Sure, I can start. We certainly have and are at EnLink. From a Canadian standpoint, our sponsor, Devon, is very active in Alberta, and we did look at a drop-down opportunity there with an access pipeline that ultimately was sold to a third party this summer. We didn't feel that we could do the access pipeline purchase and do the Tall Oak purchase, and so we chose to focus on the Stack Scoop because we thought that that was where we should be focused, but certainly have looked at Canadian opportunities. In fact, I'm from Canada, and I was brought in to help with tax structuring for Canadian opportunities for EnLink. So very much a market that we look to. From a Mexican standpoint, we owned an interest in Howard Energy Partners, and they're very active with building a pipeline into Mexico. So we recently announced that we're selling that interest because it's non-core to us because we don't control it, but certainly love the activity that's going on between Texas and Mexico, and think that there's great opportunity there as well.
In our case, we have a substantial inspection business up in Canada, and that's been very good, and we see a lot of activity up there that with the new administration might expand if the Keystone ultimately comes to be. And, you know, there's a lot of development going on in Mexico. They've got a shortage of natural gas, as Kate mentioned. Howard's doing some interesting stuff there, and I think we need to see where the administration lands on their policy with Mexico, but there could be some very interesting opportunities.
And we already do both. We have a facility in Calgary, and actually we've seen production enhancement compression start to pick up over the past few months. Red Deer and a little bit north and west in Alberta, and we also have facilities and personnel in Mexico. So both of those are the Pemex and the situation with their budget's a bit difficult right now, and hopefully that'll improve in the coming year. But yeah, we already do both.
Great, Nicholas. I guess we're out of time, unless someone has an urgent question. I think the panelists will probably be around a little bit, so please feel free to ask them or anything.